He'd be dead by then. These problems well beyond his care or control, but that was not a cheerful thought. Yuri stopped walking so abruptly that Nikolai almost ran into him. "Oh," he said. "Oh." Elisaveta Spire loomed before them, its amber panels glowing golden in the strange, flat light of the fold. Nikolai could see the shapes of giant insects frozen within each panel, and the whole structure seemed to hum like a great hive. "Sancta," Yuri whispered exultantly. He hadn't shown such veneration for the dragon, Nikolai noted, but Joris's spire had given the impression of a beast slayer. This place felt like a temple, terrifying and holy.
"You were wrong about the pyre," Zoya said to Yuri.
"Do we really know anything about what this ritual requires?"
"Only that it's dangerous," said Yuri.
"And here I thought the king would just have to eat candy and perform a monologue."
"I've already prepared some selections," said Nikolai.
As they approached, the panels of the spire shifted and arranged themselves to create an entrance. Inside, the air smelled of roses and honey, and everything shimmered with the buttery light of the gilded hour before sunset. And yet there was no sunset here. Elisaveta herself seemed cast in gold. Surrounded by bees and dragonflies, the roses of her gown blooming and dying and blooming again. "Welcome," she said warmly. If she was surprised or displeased to see Zoya, she showed no sign of it. Instead, she smiled at all of them.
"My king, shall we see if we can make the monster come when we call?"
Nikolai bowed, and Elisaveta gestured to a table where a small clay pot sat.
"When the time comes for the ritual, I will raise the thorn wood from the sands of the fold."
As she spoke, she fluttered her fingers, and a prickly iron-colored branch emerged from the pot's soil.
"When it is mature, its thorns will be as long as a cutlass. You will call to the monster, and when it emerges, you will drive a thorn through both of your hearts."
"Just how is he supposed to survive that?" asked Zoya. The little thorn tree seemed to swell, its spikes lengthening.
"It is up to the king. We can practice helping him summon and control the monster, but the fight will be his alone. If his will is strong enough, he will survive. If not, the monster will claim him."
Nikolai found he was rubbing his hand over his chest and forced himself to stop.
"My will."
"The trial is both physical and mental. It is meant to separate man from beast, and beast from man. The pain will be unlike anything you've ever known, but worse will be facing the monster."
"What exactly is it?" asked Nikolai.
This time Elisaveta's smile was pitying, as if she could sense the fear that Nikolai carried inside him, the anger and confusion that had plagued him since the demon had taken hold.
"A remnant of the Darkling's power. A sliver of his own intent and ambition. Beyond that, I cannot be sure. The monster does not want to be driven out. It will try to confuse you to keep you from completing the ritual and using the thorn. If that happens, it will take you over completely." "Do you think you can win?" she asked gently.
"We beat the Darkling once before."
"Alina beats him," corrected Zoya. An expression of distaste crossed Elisaveta's face.
"The Sun Saint," she sneered. "How desperate the people are for miracles. How low they will stoop."
Nikolai saw Zoya's eyes narrow and laid a hand on her arm. They weren't here to champion Alina's legacy.
"But it is not the Darkling you will face," Elisaveta continued.
The thorn tree shot upward. The pot cracked as the tree's roots burst through the clay in questioning tendrils.
Not exactly. This is a creature animated by the Darkling's will, just as it animated his shadow soldiers, the Nichivoya. But it has lived inside you for over 3 years. It has shared your thoughts and desires, and it will marshal them against you. It will be fighting for its life, just as surely as you are fighting for yours. Nikolai supposed he was meant to be cowed. A wise man probably would think twice about being impaled on a giant thorn, but he felt nothing but anticipation. The idea that this was a thing he could face and conquer, or even be destroyed by, was so much easier to accept than the notion of a nightmare he would have to endure forever. He'd begun to believe this thing would be with him always. There were parts of himself he despised, the endless ambition, the self-serving streak Alina had noted so accurately. And if Elisaveta was right, the monster would bring those weapons and worse to bear in the fight against him. So let it. He knew his desire for life would prove greater in the end. "When the time comes," Nikolai vowed, "I'll be ready." The tree suddenly leapt from the table, its stalk thick and pulsing, its thorns like iron daggers. It shot over the floor and stopped a bare breath from Nikolai's chest, the lethally pointed tip of a long thorn poised directly above his heart.
"I hope so," said Elisaveta.
"We have waited an eternity for you, Nikolai Lantsov. It would be a shame if you failed us now."
Nikolai exchanged a glance with Zoya. Yuri was gazing at Elisaveta with naked adoration, helpful as always.
"I'm fairly sure you're trying to frighten me," said Nikolai, reaching out a finger to touch the tip of the thorn. "I'm not sure why, but may I suggest a spider wearing a suit?"
"Why a suit?" asked Zoya, frowning. "Why not just a spider?"
"Where did he get the suit? How did he fasten the buttons? Why does he feel the need to dress for the occasion?" Elisaveta was studying them. She flicked her fingers and the thorn tree receded.
"I had intended to torture the monk to force your darkness to the fore," she said contemplatively. "But best to cut to the chase."
She lifted a hand and the floor rose around Zoya, encasing her in glistening panels of amber. Zoya shouted, her face startled and frightened before her instincts took hold. She threw her hands out, buffeting the luminous walls with the force of her power. A golden substance began to rise from her feet, filling the chamber. Nikolai reached for Zoya, but the thornwood grew up between them in a wild, impenetrable tangle. There were thorns all around him, a wall of deadly gray spikes.
"Stop this, Elisaveta," he shouted, though he could no longer see the saint. He heard Zoya scream. "I know you're not going to kill her," he said, though he knew no such thing. "Juris needs her." Elisaveta appeared from the thicket surrounded by a bloom of roses.
"Do you think I care what Juris needs? It's freedom I require, and if losing her will drive you to act, that seems a small price."
Nikolai lunged at her, but Elisaveta vanished into the thornwood. He leapt onto the brambles, ignoring the pain as the thorns jabbed at him through his clothes. They were wickedly sharp, sinking into his flesh like teeth.
"You will have to fly, my king," said Elisaveta's voice, "or you will never be free. And neither will we."
Zoya's screams rose. From somewhere in the thicket, Yuri cried,
"Oh no, please, you must not, I beg you."
Nikolai forced his eyes shut.
"Come on, you bastard," he implored the monster. "You want to spread your wings? This is your chance. I'll even let you gnaw on that so-called saint as a thank you."
But if the monster was listening, it must be laughing, too. Whatever dark thing resided within him had no interest in playing this game.
"The saint will not harm her," Nikolai told himself. "It's a ploy."
And then Zoya's screams stopped. Yuri was sobbing.
"Zoya!" Nikolai shouted. "Zoya!"
He hurled himself against the barbed thicket.
"Zoya!"
he yelled. But it emerged as a snarl. This time he felt the creature inside him drag its way to the surface, as if its talons were scraping against his chest cavity.
No, he did not want this, did not want to give the monster control.
but another voice within him hissed.
Yes. Remember, he told himself. Remember who you are.
He felt his claws emerge, felt his teeth grow long.
I am Nikolai Lansoff, privateer and king.
He screamed as the wings burst through his back, and he rose up over the thornwood, into the high cavern of the tower.
Remember who you are.
Elisaveta gazed up at him, her face triumphant. Yuri wept. Beside them, Zoya floated in a golden sarcophagus, like an angel caught in amber. Her eyes closed, her body still. He did not recognize the sound that tore from his throat as he hurled his body at Zoya's prison. He struck it with a bone-crunching thud, but it did not budge. He turned on Elisaveta, snarling.
I am the monster, and the monster is me.
He could feel the demon fighting for control even as it lent him his strength, but Elisaveta only smiled, gentle, beneficent. With a wave of her hand, the amber walls containing Zoya collapsed, and the thornwood wilted into the floor.
He seized Zoya's limp body before it could fall.
She was covered in golden sap. Elisaveta closed her fist, and Zoya began to cough. She opened her eyes, lashes thick with resin, blinked in confusion. Then her face flooded with terror, and she began to thrash in his arms. He wanted to soothe her. He wanted to... The smell of her fear mingled with the sap. It made him feel drunk. It made him feel hungry. All he wanted was to dig his claws into her flesh. All he wanted was to consume her.
Remember, he demanded. Remember who you are. Nikolai Lansoff, ruler of Ravka, privateer, soldier, second son of a disgraced king.
A growl of pure appetite rumbled through him as Zoya tried to scramble away, her movements stunted by the weight of the sap.
Remember who she is.
Zoya sitting beside him writing correspondence. Zoya glowering at a new crop of students. Zoya holding him in the confines of a coach as he shook and shook and waited for the monster to leave him. He clung tightly to the recollection of that sensation, that terrible trembling.
Go, he demanded. Go!
Grudgingly, haltingly, the monster sank back into whatever dark place it resided, leaving the acrid taste of something burning in Nikolai's mouth. He collapsed, shaking to his knees. He couldn't bear to look at Zoya's face and see the disgust there. There would be no coming back from this. He felt her hands on his shoulders and forced himself to meet her gaze. She was beaming.
You did it, she said. You called him up, and then you sent him packing.
You were almost killed, he said in disbelief.
She grinned wider.
But I wasn't.
Elisaveta tapped the table. So I am forgiven, squalor? That depends on how hard it is to get this stuff out of my hair. Elisaveta raised her hands, and the sap slid from Zoya in golden rivulets, returning to the floor where it solidified. Yuri wiped the tears from his face.
Will Commander Nazielensky have to endure this ordeal every time?
I'll do it if I have to.
Elisaveta shrugged.
Let's hope not.
Zoya offered him her hand.
You open the door.
Nikolai let her help him to his feet, forced himself to celebrate with the others. But he'd felt the will of the monster. And he wondered, when the time came, if he'd be able to match its ferocity. He'd open the door.
He doubted it would be so easy to close the next time.
Chapter 23. Isaac. He'd made it through 3 days of parties, dinners, and meetings, and no one had attempted to murder him again. It was a bit like being on the front. You survived for an hour. Then another hour. You hoped to make it through the day. At night, Isaac fell into bed and lay staring at the ceiling, heart pounding, thinking of the many things he'd done wrong and the many more things he was bound to do wrong tomorrow. Today they were to enjoy the morning boating on the lake beside the little palace, and then they would picnic on its shores.
We've arranged for you to spend time with the Shoe Princess before lunch, Tamar had told him.
And I do what with her?
Be charming. Ask her about her guards and how long she's known them. Get us any information you can.
Can't you and Tolia just bond with the Tavgarad over your shoe childhoods or something?
The twins had exchanged a glance.
We're worse than Ravkins to them, said Tamar. We had a shoe father, but we wear the tattoos of the Sun Saint and serve a foreign king.
Why did you choose service to Ravka?
We didn't, said Tamar.
Tolia put his hand to his heart.
We chose Alina. We chose Nikolai. All of this,
he gestured to the palace grounds,
means nothing.
Isaac didn't know what to say to that. He considered himself a patriot, but he could admit that, unlike the king, Ravka had never been particularly kind to him.
Chat with Princess Eri, said Tamar. Get her talking.
Hypothetically, if I weren't possessed of natural charisma and a gift for witty conversation, just how would I do that?
Tamar rolled her eyes, but Tolia said,
Compliment her. Express your admiration for shoe culture. You might consider reciting.
Oh, for saint's sake, Tolia. That's the last thing he should do.
Tamar knelt in front of Isaac.
Just listen to her. Ask her questions. Women don't want to be seduced. They want to be seen and listened to. You can't do either of those things if you're thinking up strategies on how to win her over, or reciting the fourth epic of Craigie.
There is no fourth epic of Craigie, growled Tolia. The third was unfinished by the poet Ilan.
Then that's definitely the one he should recite.
Why did the thought of a simple conversation make Isaac's heart rattle? Possibly because he'd never been good at talking to girls, other than his sisters. But arguing with Belka and Petya over the price of ribbon was a far cry from making small talk with royals. And he was supposed to somehow wheedle information from a princess? He tried to remind himself that he was handsome now, a fact that took him by surprise every time he caught a glimpse of himself in a mirror. He hadn't been ugly before, just unremarkable. Tidy brown hair that curled if he left it too long. Regular enough features, slightly crooked bottom teeth. His mother had told him he was nice-looking, but she'd also told his sisters she had a lovely singing voice, and that was definitely not the case. Now Isaac tried to look at ease, as he reclined on a cushioned divan on the royal barge, attempting his best approximation of Nikolai's relaxed slouch. He'd spent too many years standing at attention. Before him, elegantly decorated sloops and barges dotted the lake like water lilies, banners snapping, awnings striped in Ravkin blue and gold. The lake was too cold for swimming, but the tide makers had heated its surface so that mist rose from the water in dense clouds, which squallers manipulated into symbols of various countries and families of standing. Isaac had permitted himself a few sips from a tiny bell-shaped glass of apricot wine to try to soothe his nerves, but still remained alert, listening to the conversation as one of the Fjerdan ambassadors asked if they might take a tour of the Grisha school.
Of course you may, said Jinya. It would be our great pleasure.
Isaac did not think he imagined the current of excitement that passed between the ambassador and another member of his delegation. Jinya smoothed her skirts and added,
But I fear you may find it boring. The students are currently traveling with their teachers as part of their instruction.
All of them?
Yes, said Jinya. We find work in the field is so beneficial for a child's education, and I must say I'm not sorry for the peace and quiet. Young Grisha can be quite high-spirited, as I'm sure you can imagine. We didn't want them getting underfoot with such important new friends visiting.
Isaac had never known the Grisha students to be underfoot. They were kept busy and the school was isolated enough from the rest of the palace that they would have had trouble getting anywhere without notice. No, they'd been moved for their safety. And the Fjerdans knew it.
You evacuated all of them?
The ambassador asked coldly.
Evacuated? Said Jinya with an amused laugh. That would imply there was some kind of threat.
She tapped the ambassador on the knee playfully.
A threat to a group of children who could set fire to this barge and stop the hearts of everyone on it with the sweep of a hand.
She dabbed at her eyes.
It is too droll.
Isaac turned to Jenya as the Fjartans walked to the sloop's railing to enjoy the view and possibly to seethe.
You sent the students away to protect them.
Of course, said Jenya, all mirth gone. You think we would keep one of Ravka's greatest assets here when a bomb or poison gas could eliminate an entire new generation of Grisha in moments? But a fearful Fjartan is one less likely to act. And I just relish the idea of them having bad dreams about a bunch of schoolchildren. Isaac gave a slight shake of his head.
Listening to you talk is like watching a sailor who knows the secret shape of a bay. Of all the places where storms strike and the rocky spots where ships run aground. You navigate these waters with such surety.
Jenya was quiet for a long time. I was thrown into the water early, she said. The Darkling gave me to the Queen of Ravka as a gift when I was just a little girl. A pretty thing who could be of service to her.
Then you knew the king as a boy?
I saw him and his brother in passing. I was a cherished servant, but a servant all the same. They were very loud. She toyed with one of her topaz earrings. The household staff used to call them the two headaches. How I envied them. The way they were free to run and play and make trouble.
But to be a favorite of the queen, said Isaac, that must have been a great honor.
Jenya popped a slice of plum into her mouth. For a time, I was the queen's doll. She would dress me in lovely clothes and brush my hair and let me sleep at the foot of her bed and sit beside her at meals. I watched the sharks and learned. When I grew older, and I had the misfortune of catching the old king's eye. Jenya wiped her fingers slowly on a linen napkin, the leavings of the plum staining the cloth. I convinced myself that the suffering I endured was an honor, because I was the Darkling's soldier and his spy. He trusted me above all others, and one day, all would know the good I'd done him. He could not have managed his coup so easily without the information I fed him. Isaac stared at her.
You are confessing to treason, he whispered.
Sweet Isaac, she said with a smile. Nikolai Lanthoff pardoned me long ago. And in that moment he earned my loyalty forever. The Darkling threw me into the water, then watched me drown to serve his own purposes.
So he was as cruel as the stories say?
Cruel? Oh, yes. But he didn't leave me to the king's predations to punish me. He just never even considered my misery. What was the anguish of one girl if it might help him earn an empire? He was playing a long and complicated game. It was only when I dared to think for myself, when I interfered with his grand plan, that he set his monsters on me and... A loud splash sounded from somewhere on the lake. They stood in time to see a billow of yellow silk sinking beneath the surface near a barge crowded with members of the Kerch delegation. One of the merchant's daughters had fallen into the water and was sinking fast.
Jump in, whispered Jenya furiously. Go save her.
There are Grisha.
Nikolai wouldn't wait for the Grisha.
She was right, but I can't swim.
Please tell me you mean that metaphorically.
Afraid not. He said, panic rising.
Why didn't you tell me?
It just never came up.
Just jump, said Jenya. And don't you dare flail. Sink as fast as you can and we'll do the rest.
Isaac couldn't believe she was serious, but one look at her expression made it clear this was no joke.
Well,
he thought, as he leapt onto the railing and launched himself into the water with what he hoped was a modicum of grace.
At least if I drown, I won't have to sit through dinner.
The water was bitterly cold, and as he sank, everything in Isaac's body demanded that he move, fight, do something to get back to warmth and air.
Do not flail.
He remained still, the ache building in his lungs as panic began to set in.
He looked up, up to the dim glow of light at the surface. It seemed impossibly far away, the lake dark and silent around him, an endless starless sky. A rotten place to die.
Is this it?
He wondered.
Am I really going to drown to preserve the king's reputation as a hero?
Then Nadia had hold of his arm. She was surrounded by a bubble of air that she had created, and that two tide makers beside her were propelling forward. She yanked him into the circle of air, and he took a long, gasping breath. Come on, she said. He felt the current around him moving, dragging them along like a fast-running river. A bundle of yellow silk billowed in the water ahead of them. The girl, Birgitta Schenk, wasn't moving. Her eyes were closed and her hair was splayed around her face like a corona.
Oh, saints, was she dead?
Grab her, said Nadia. And as soon as his hand closed over her wrist, they were shooting through the water again. They emerged on the opposite side of the tiny island at the lake's center, away from the pleasure crafts. Tolia and Tamar were waiting. They pulled Birgitta onto the steps of one of the practice pavilions and began the work of trying to revive her.
Please tell me she's alive, said Isaac. There's a pulse, replied Tolia. But there's water in her lungs.
A moment later, Birgitta coughed, lake water spewing from her lips.
Scatter, commanded Tolia.
Be charming, Tamar said, as she disappeared with the others into the mist.
You're a hero.
Isaac bent over the girl, trying to remember that it would be the king's face she would see.
Miss Schenk, he said. Birgitta, are you quite well?
Her long lashes fluttered. She looked up at him with dazed green eyes and burst out crying.
Well, perhaps being handsome wasn't a cure for everything. You almost drowned, he said. You've cause to be emotional. Come, we must get you warm.
Isaac felt frozen and exhausted too, but he forced himself to do what he thought would look best. He slipped his arm beneath the girl's legs and lifted her into his arms.
All saints, she was heavy. Was so much silk really necessary?
She leaned her head against his chest, and Isaac strode across the island, his teeth chattering, his boots squelching wetly until they emerged from the trees onto the island's opposite bank. Everyone was peering at the water as would-be rescuers paddled around the Kirch boat, and Grisha tidemakers pulled back the lake in sheaves of water that hovered above the surface. Someone caught sight of Isaac and Birgitta and shouted,
There they are!
She's right as rain, Isaac called, but twice as damp. We could both use some dry clothes and some hot tea.
The crowd burst into applause. Isaac set down Birgitta before his arms gave out, depositing her on the sand like a pile of wet laundry. He bowed and managed to stop his teeth chattering long enough to kiss her hand. He'd graduated from minor breaches of etiquette to nearly getting himself and someone else drowned. Perhaps tomorrow, he'd manage to burn down the place. Birgitta Schenk and Isaac were hustled onto the royal barge, wrapped in blankets and dosed with hot brandy as servants chafed their hands. But it wasn't until he was back in Nikolai's quarters and submerged in a steaming bath in the king's vast tub that Isaac finally started to feel warm again. Jenya and the others had remained in intense conversation in the sitting room, while Isaac had been left to soak in peace. He was going to miss this tub when the king returned. The rest he could do without. He stayed in the bath until the water turned cold and he'd started to prune. He didn't particularly want to face the people waiting next door, but he forced himself out of the tub and dried himself off with one of the long linen bath sheets. Nikolai employed no valet, which had been a relief to Isaac. He hadn't had anyone help him dress since he was a child. He put on the king's soft breeches and boots, the shirt and suspenders, the fitted coat embroidered with the Lansoff eagle. He could admit the clothes weren't a bad part of the deal either. They had been constructed meticulously and were as comfortable as they were elegant. As Isaac adjusted his coat, his fingers touched on something in the right pocket. He was always finding things tucked away in the pockets of the king's clothes. A note the king had scrawled to himself, or a sketch of what might be a new invention. A small silver bead. This time he pulled a tiny knot of wire from his coat. It had been fashioned into the shape of a sailing ship. He set it on the king's vanity.
"We think this may actually be a good thing," said Tamar, as Isaac entered the sitting room.
He joined them by the fire, glad for its warmth.
"So should I try to drown more often?"
"It wasn't ideal," Jenya said, pouring him a cup of tea. "You missed your chance to chat with Princess Aerie. But we made the best of it. And the king looked like a hero."
"The carry was a nice touch," said Tamar.
"Very heroic," said Tolia. "Like a prince out of the epic poems. And so Ivan the Gilded Hair bore her across the..."
"Keep reciting poetry, and I will personally drown you in the lake," said Tamar.
Tolia scowled and muttered,
"It's a classic,"
into his tea. Isaac didn't agree, but he doubted this was the time to debate poetry.
Jenya nudged David, and he looked up from the treatise he was reading.
"We traced the trigger device, used to rig the king's door with arsine gas. It's most likely Fyrdin."
"Will they be arrested?" asked Isaac. Tamar looked almost bemused. "Of course not. It's not something we can actually prove, and in a way, this is good news."
"Of course," said Isaac.
He scratched his ear.
"Exactly how is it good news?"
"We already suspected the Fjerdins didn't come to play.
If it had been the Kirch or the Shoe, we would have had real cause to worry. This means the Shoe are still open to an alliance.
We were curious to see who might attempt the king's life."
"Without risking the king?"
Isaac asked, surprised at the bitter edge in his voice.
Tolia rested a giant hand on his shoulder.
"We would never let harm come to you, Isaac."
"I know," said Isaac.
But did he? And could he really complain?
It was a soldier's lot to be expendable. A guard's job was to put himself between his ruler and harm. Wasn't that exactly what he was doing now?
Tamar leaned back in her chair and crossed her long legs.
"I've searched the chambers of the Shoe Guards."
"There are guests,"
protested Tolia.
"There are enemies," said Tamar.
"And potential allies," said Jenya. "It wouldn't do to make them mad."
"We were cautious.
But there was little to learn. The few journals I found were kept in code, and I doubt any member of the Tavgarad would be foolish enough to put damning details to paper."
"And the Kirch made an attempt on our labs,"
said Tolia. David looked up from his reading, startled.
Did they get in?" "We let them make it all the way to the fabricator workshops."
"Oh," said David, losing interest.
"We're not concerned about that?" asked Isaac.
"The real work happens elsewhere," said Tamar. "We even planted some fake blueprints for them to find. All of it should help set the stage for our performance at the Gilded Bog."
"We're going to the Gilded Bog?"
asked Isaac, unable to hide his excitement.
"Unfortunately,"
said Tolia. Jenya tucked her slippered feet beneath her. "We'll be using Count Kerrigan's lake to show the Kirch our prototype of the Ismarsia." A look passed between the others that Isaac didn't understand. But that was nothing new. He assumed someone would tell him what exactly an Ismarsia was, so he could nod sagely about the subject when the time came.
"You will be working," added Tamar, "not sampling Kerrigan's entertainments."
"Of course,"
said Isaac. But he could at least get a glimpse of what all the fuss was about. Jenya pushed a sheaf of papers over to him. "Here are notes for the dinner tonight. You won't be expected to make a speech, but this will be a more formal affair, so you'll need to do your best to seem at ease. Tomorrow is the hunt."
"I can hunt at least," said Isaac with relief.
"Not like a gentleman hunts. But Nikolai was never much for the sport anyway. He has a fondness for foxes. The hunt is just an excuse to ride and get to know the hopefuls. Remember to spread your conversation evenly amongst them. We'll go over the particulars tonight after dinner." They filed out and Isaac let his head flop back, staring at the gilded ceiling. He felt both tired and restless. He glanced at the notes on place settings and how to eat oysters, and tossed them aside.
He needed to clear his head. As soon as he opened the door, Tolia was there.
There's something wrong. I just want to take a walk.
Tolia fell back a few steps as Isaac made his way down the hall, but it was still unsettling to know he was being watched. There were rumors Nikolai had run away from university to pursue a life of adventure on the high seas as the privateer Sturmhund. A ridiculous story, but Isaac could understand the impulse. Who wouldn't choose that kind of freedom over this constant performance? He passed through the portrait galley, ignoring the paintings of countless Lantsov kings and queens, and entered the conservatory. It was Isaac's favorite place in the Grand Palace. The high-ceilinged room ran half the length of the southern wing. Sunlight streamed through the walls made entirely of glass panels, and steam pipes heated the red tile floor. The conservatory's winding paths were lined with potted fruit trees and tall palms, flowering shrubs that overflowed the walkways, and hedges trimmed into tiered arches and lattices. An artificial stream flowed through the room's center, narrowing and widening to form lily ponds and reflecting pools. A girl was seated by one of the ponds. No, not a girl. A princess. Eri Kir Taban, daughter of heaven. The shoe usually carried the names of one or both of their parents, but the royal family all took the name of the first shoe queen and founder of the Taban dynasty. There were Ravkin guards and shoe Tavgarad stationed at the room's perimeter. He should have noticed them sooner, but he'd been too preoccupied. Distraction was something neither a guard nor a king could afford. So this was his chance. He could make up for his missed meeting with the princess and try to gather the information Jenny and the others required. Be charming. Right. Charming. But before he could decide on a good opening line, the princess lifted her head. She rose hurriedly and curtsied.
Your Highness.
I didn't mean to intrude on your peace, he said in Shu.
I am a guest here. There can be no intrusion.
She glanced at the guards.
Would you care to sit and talk a while?
There. I didn't even have to ask.
And yet he still wanted to turn and scurry right back through the door. But to say no now would be seen as a snub. Besides, Tolia might well block the door and refuse to let him through.
Isaac took a seat beside her on the wide rock next to the pond. The air smelled of sweet orange blossom, and the low splash of fish at play in the water was soothing. It might have been a pleasant place to rest if not for the guards glowering in the doorways. Isaac vowed that when he had his face back and returned to duty, he'd try to look a little friendlier.
Thank you for joining me, Eri said.
It's my pleasure.
Hardly that, she murmured with a small smile. No doubt you came here to be alone, as alone as we can ever be, just as I did.
But if you wish to be alone, why invite me to join you?
I must be seen to be making an effort, or the guards will report back to my sister, and then I will never hear the end of it.
Your sister?
Maki Kir Taban, born of heaven, our most celestial princess who will inherit the crown and rule wisely and justly for many years.
And what will you do? Asked Isaac.
A woman wants to be listened to. Marry you, of course.
Of course, Isaac said, willing himself not to squirm. But if you were not to marry me?
At this, she looked almost panicked, as if the question was not one that had been scripted for her, and she wasn't at all sure how honest she should be.
Isaac could sympathize.
Please, he said gently, both to put her at ease and because he found he was genuinely curious.
I'd like to know.
She brushed her thumb over the silk of her gown.
I suppose that if I hadn't been born Taban, I would like to be a soldier. Maybe even a member of the Tavgarad.
Truly,
he couldn't help but laugh.
It was too absurd to contemplate a guard pretending to be a prince talking to a princess who wanted to be a royal guard.
She frowned slightly.
It isn't kind to laugh.
Instantly, Isaac sobered.
I didn't mean to insult you. I was just surprised. Serving in the Royal Guard is a very noble calling, and it would allow some measure of freedom, though even guards have duties.
Yes, but they're not forced to pose and preen just to be sold off like chattel.
She paled, realizing what she'd said.
Forgive me, I didn't mean... It would be my greatest honor.
Don't apologize, please. I ask for your honesty. I don't expect every woman I meet to be eager to wed me.
A crease appeared between her brows.
You don't?
Damn it, another misstep.
Isaac winked.
Not at first. That was a far more Nikolai answer, though the princess looked slightly disappointed.
You can make it up to me, said Airy. I have been honest with you. Now perhaps you will share a secret with me. It's only fair.
I'm not the king of Ravka, just a lowly grunt trying not to perspire in his fancy clothes.
No, that was definitely not the right reply. Isaac supposed he should say something flirtatious, but he wasn't sure which secrets belonged to him and which belonged to the king.
Very well. My secret is that I did wish to be alone, but that I'm still enjoying your company. It's been a hard morning.
Has it?
A girl almost drowned.
Airy released an unprincess-like snort.
It's her own fault for throwing herself in the lake.
Pardon?
I would wager my best axe there was nothing accidental about her plunge into the water.
Your best axe?
Airy tucked a strand of dark hair behind her ear.
I am an avid collector.
A princess who wanted to be a palace guard and who liked weapons? She was at least interesting.
How can you be so sure the Schenk girl jumped? He asked.
Because my own advisor suggested I do the same thing last night.
Isaac stared.
You're saying that she risked her own life just to...
gain the notice of a king and give him the chance to play hero?
Airy sniffed and smoothed the silk of her gown.
A reasonable gamble, but not one I was prepared to make.
He studied her. Not when you could simply wait for a pensive king to amble by and find you looking like a painting in green silk with flowers in your hair.
Her golden eyes shifted away guiltily.
How long were you waiting, hoping I might stroll by?
She bit her lip.
2 hours and 12 minutes, give or take.
He was both annoyed and pleased that she'd actually been frank.
That stone ledge can't be very comfortable.
I regret to say I can no longer feel my buttocks.
At that, Isaac burst out laughing, then caught himself. That was not Nikolai's laugh. He saw one of the palace guards cock his head to the side.
Drukin.
Isaac had worked countless shifts with him around the palace. He had every reason to recognize Isaac's laugh. All saints, Isaac was tired of this charade already. But the princess had provided him an opening.
If you can't manage a short stint sitting on a rock, I don't see how you could hope to fill the role of guard standing at attention for hours.
Then thank goodness I was born royal.
I confess I know little of the Tavgarad,
said Isaac, hoping his voice sounded natural.
Are they drawn from noble families?
They aren't drawn from anywhere, Airy said, a surprising bite to her voice. They come from every town and every village where they test and train and hope to be chosen. There is no greater honor
than defending you.
He couldn't keep the smile from his voice. Airy bit her lip.
The Taban line. I'm one of the lesser jewels in the crown.
Isaac found that hard to believe. She was awfully pretty. He couldn't imagine what her sisters looked like if she was the plain one. He pressed on.
It must be a hard life, even if it is rewarding. Do they leave their families behind, as the Grisha do?
She stiffened slightly.
They're happy to do so.
She trailed a hand over the water. I think it's hardest for the twins.
Twins?
They're very common among our people.
She bobbed her head toward Tolia.
like the Kebbatar.
It's an interesting word, Kebbin. We don't have one like it in Hrothgar.
It could mean close kin or twin, but also someone bound to your heart. Eri closed her eyes and recited. Everyone mourns the first blossom. Who will weep for the rest that fall? Isaac couldn't help but smile. It seemed Tolia's advice would come in handy after all.
I will remain to sing for you, long after the spring has gone.
You know it? Eri said in surprise.
I learned it when I was first studying Shu.
It was a poem simply titled, Kebbin Ah. And there was considerable debate over whether the title should be translated as My Dear, or My Kin, or My Only. It's an old poem, long out of fashion, but it describes the spirit of Kebbin well.
I believe it was set to music, Isaac said. I've been told you play the couture. She bunched her hands in her silks, her expression tightening again.
Yes, she said curtly. What had he done wrong?
I've found.
He fumbled, afraid he might be about to botch everything horribly.
I've found that this position, this life of display, can take the savor from many things I once enjoyed.
For a moment, Eri looked startled, even frightened. Then something sparked in her eyes, and she leaned forward. I know, she whispered. At least if we were guards, we could spend the day doing something more exciting. We could go riding.
Eat with our fingers.
Eri lowered her chin and whispered, Belch.
With fervor.
We could... Oh, dear, said Eri. I think we have company. And sure enough, down both garden paths he saw the hopefuls and their chaperones approaching like a flock of beautifully dressed birds of prey.
Someone must have reported we were in private conversation.
Perhaps they'll all throw themselves into the pond to get your attention, whispered Eri. And Isaac had to resist the urge to laugh again. What amuses the king so? Asked the Fjordan princess as she approached, her fan fashioned to resemble an elegant spray of frost.
Many things, I must confess, said Isaac. The king is a simple man.
It wasn't true, but so little was these days. Chapter 24 Nina. Nina knew getting the women out of the fort would be no small challenge. Security would be tighter thanks to her little stunt, but they could at least hope that the soldiers might think the breach had been the result of a novitiate out to pull a prank, or attempting a meeting with a soldier, not the work of a Hrothgar spy. When Nina met with Leonie and Adric to plan, they kept their discussions in Zemini and made sure to talk well away from the convent, under the cover of one of their excursions to sell the loading devices. They'd actually made sales to a few of the local fishermen who were attempting to hunt game for hides and meat, now that the fish seemed to be dying off. They would have to restock soon. That morning, Nina had seen a flash of white fur appearing and disappearing through the trees as they trekked out of town. She'd strayed away from Adric and Leonie and wended her way into the woods as silently as she could. There she'd seen Trassel prowling the far banks of the river. Her heart had caught in her throat when she'd glimpsed the other shapes in the woods. Gray wolves. But these animals did not seem to have the orange eyes and rangy bodies of those she'd encountered on the ice. Every time one of them moved toward the water, Trassel would snap his jaws and the gray wolves would edge farther back into the trees. He's hurting them, she realized. He's keeping them away from the poisoned river. She wanted to stay and watch, to see if he might let her approach, even if he continued to turn his nose up at her kitchen scraps. But Adric and Leonie were waiting, and so were the girls on the mountaintop. Reluctantly, she left Trassel behind and returned to the sledge. The plan seemed simple enough. Get the women and their babies out, and make it through the checkpoint at the base of the hill before anyone knew the prisoners were missing. Leonie hadn't been thrilled to learn they'd need explosives.
I have barely any training in blasting powders, she'd said, as they repacked their wares. And long fuses are almost always trouble.
We need a distraction, said Nina. Once we get clear, the bombs will start a fire in the active portion of the factory that will spread to the maternity ward. By the time it's extinguished and they realize there are no bodies to find, the girls will be well on their way to Hyar.
There, a whaler commissioned by members of the Hringsa would be waiting to take them to Ravka. Actually, the crew would be expecting Grisha fugitives, not a tide of young women and infants addicted to what Leonie suspected was synthetic parem, or something very much like it. But Nina would find some way to explain.
We can't tell the girls who we are. Not if we want them docile.
Leonie looked uneasy.
Shouldn't they have a choice in this?
Parem takes away choice.
All they'll be thinking of is when the next fix will come. If we want them to go with us quietly, they can't know we're taking them away from their supply. We should try to acquire some ordinary Jirta for them, too. It may help with the withdrawal. Adric squinted down the road.
What happens when they realize that next fix isn't coming?
Leonie, could you create a sedative mild enough to keep them manageable, but safe enough for the mothers who are still carrying?
Are we really talking about sedating pregnant women?
Adric asked.
What if we get the dose wrong?
I don't like it either, but I know what it's like to be in the grips of that longing.
I can do it, said Leonie. I think, but...
She looked down at the knot she was tying.
What if they don't come back from this? We could be dooming them to a horrific journey, maybe even death.
Nina remembered the agony of her battle with Parem too well. She'd begged for death, prayed for it. Without Matthias, she wasn't sure she could have held on, and that had just been the first struggle. What would she have done without Inej to give her purpose, or Jesper to make her laugh? Even that little bastard Kaz had done his part, ruthless to the last. She'd needed all of them to keep her going in those long, merciless days as she fought her way back to herself. These women would be without family or friends in a foreign land.
They would have to learn to lean on one another, if they survived.
Nina looked at Leonie, at Adric.
I won't pretend I'm thinking straight. Seeing those women, those girls that way, I understand what Parem does.
I've been through that war. I know what I would choose. And you're willing to make that choice for them? Said Adric.
We all have to be willing.
Leonie took a deep breath.
I wouldn't want to live under another's control. I wouldn't want to doom my child to a life of that.
Adric? Nina asked.
I told you what I think, Nina. We're risking our lives and the lives of other Grisha to deliver what I suspect will be a ship full of corpses to Ravka. But I won't turn my back on them. If nothing else, I'll have something new to complain about for the rest of my days.
You're welcome, said Nina. Adric gave her a dour little bow.
But how are we supposed to convince the mothers or the guards that a one-armed man and two women have any business being there?
We can get you a uniform and stuff your sleeve. Leonie and I can wear Spring Maiden pinafores.
You think they won't notice that I can barely speak Fjärden and that I'm trying to drive a team of horses with one hand?
Hanna will help.
Are you sure?
Leonie asked.
I saw her face the other night. She's been under the Well Mother's thumb a long time.
Not just the Well Mother. Her parents. All of Fjärda. But Hanna had still lied for Nina. She defied the dictates of the convent to help people who needed her. She'd still managed to keep the fierce part of her heart alive in this wretched place. Adric leaned back against the cart.
If she finds out we're Grisha...
She's Grisha.
And she hates herself. Don't think she won't turn that hatred on us. Even if we get through this without revealing who we really are, she'll be the one left to face the consequences when we're gone.
Nina shifted uneasily, and Adric's brows rose.
You think she'll go with us? Oh, Zenik. I thought Leonie was the hopeless optimist.
Hanna doesn't belong here.
Even if she managed to keep her powers a secret, Fjärda would break Hanna's spirit eventually.
Nina didn't think she could bear that particular casualty in this war. Adric studied her.
Don't make us the only option, Nina. It's not something Hanna will forgive.
She might not forgive me, Nina thought. But at least she'll survive. When Nina arrived in the classroom the next day, she was startled to find not just Hanna waiting, but one of the Spring Maidens.
Cory of the Well would like to learn, too,
Hanna said dully. Nina tried to look delighted.
Another student! Excellent! Do you have any knowledge of Zemini?
No, Cory said sulkily. Clearly she wasn't thrilled to be stuck with this duty, and clearly the Well Mother thought Nina and Hanna shouldn't be left alone.
Then we'll begin at the beginning. Let's start with the verb to pray.
Hanna rolled her eyes, and Nina found it hard not to laugh. If this was the worst challenge they faced over the next few days, Nina would count them very lucky indeed. But as she was walking Hanna and Cory through some basic vocabulary, chair, desk, window, sky, girl, cloud, a knock came, and a novitiate poked her head through the door. It was the peach-cheeked girl who'd approached Nina in the woods, one of the same novitiates who had ridden with Hanna as a Fjerdin soldier. The girl curtsied to Cory, who asked,
What is it?
The Well Mother sent me to fetch you, Hanna, said the novitiate. Your father is here.
Hanna's whole body seemed to crumple like a flower wilting in a sudden frost. Nina had seen her scared, angry. But this was something new and unwelcome, as if all the fire that animated her had suddenly and abruptly banked. Even Cory looked worried as she said,
Go on then,
to Hanna. Hanna closed her workbook and rose. Nina knew she shouldn't, but as Hanna walked past, she grabbed her hand and squeezed it tightly. Hanna glanced at the Spring Maiden, who was watching them with narrowed eyes, then squeezed back.
It will be all right, whispered Nina. Adawe.
The first verb she'd taught Hanna.
Fight.
Hanna's spine straightened slightly. She released Nina's hand, but the novitiate added,
He wishes to meet you too, Uncle Yanderstadt.
Good. If Hanna's father wanted to meet his daughter's teacher, she would do her best to handle and pacify him. Maybe she could help Hanna weather the storm. She rose.
Andawesi,
Hanna said, full lips quirking in a smile. We fight. When they reached the chapel, the novitiate led them down a long hall, and Nina realized they were headed to the same office where she and Hanna had met with the Well Mother to discuss language classes. The Well Mother waited at her desk, just as she had before, and a tall man of military bearing stood by the window, hands clasped behind his back. A thick red scar ran along the base of his pale skull. Nina felt something cold unfurl in her belly.
Well, Mother, said Hanna, curtsying deeply. Min Vater?
Nina knew who it would be before he turned. But there was nothing she could do to stop the terror that seized her as she looked once more into Jarl Broom's cold blue eyes. The last time Nina had encountered Jarl Broom, he'd tried to imprison and enslave her. She'd been deep in the grips of her first and only dose of Jurda Parem when she'd faced him and his Druskella in the Jerholm Harbor. She'd wanted to murder him, and she could have with barely a thought. But Matthias had begged her to show mercy, and she had. She'd left Broom and his men alive, though in a last petty act she'd torn the scalp from his head. Someone had apparently sewn it back on. Nina sank into a low curtsy, training her eyes on the floor, trying to steal a moment to gather her wits and hide her fear. Get yourself together, Zenik, she ordered herself. Broom had seen through her clumsy disguise when she'd met him in the ice court. But now she'd been tailored by the master, Jenya Safin. Her very bones and body had been altered, and she knew her command of the Fjerdin language was pristine. She remembered what she'd said to Hanna. That performance began in the body, and right now Nina needed to give the performance of her life. Instead of hiding her fear, she would use it. It was her loathing she needed to bury. When she rose from her curtsy,